Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we dig into another part of Cole's legacy, black lung disease. Doctors and researchers say there's a spike in the number of miners suffering from the worst form of the disease.
Something has happened that has caused these numbers.
Some miners, like Mackie Branham, are hoping for a lung transplant.
The more I talk, the more I get out of breath. It's just a lot of pressure in my chest all the times.
But even for miners lucky enough to get a transplant, organ rejection is always a concern, oftentimes within the first year of the surgery. Robert Bailey says he was one of the blessed ones.
I felt like I was led to be baptized once I got out. Unite these new lungs with my body and God's spirit.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Back in March, we aired a special report about a rise in the number of chronic black lung cases. Since then, NPR's ongoing investigation uncovered an additional 1,000 cases of the worst form of black lung disease in Appalachia. That brings the NPR count of progressive massive fibrosis to nearly 2,000 cases in the region, all of which were diagnosed since 2010. Also, since then, Congress has been on an almost constant roller coaster of debate surrounding the future of health care in our country. For many miners who are suffering from black lung, this issue is still as relevant today as it was back when we first aired this report. So we're going to revisit this story and the voices of those who are most affected by this disease. Coal mining has touched so many aspects of life here in Appalachia. The coal industry has provided more than just jobs. It's helped build towns, bridges, and it's even provided money for many Appalachians to go to college. We also have a deep cultural connection to coal and its history. But as much good as the coal industry has done for our region, there's no denying that it's changed the landscape of our mountains and infected many miners with a deadly disease known as black lung. And for some, living with black lung or watching loved ones suffer is a way of life. On today's show, we're going to look at this part of coal's legacy and the complicated, often broken or mismanaged system that's meant to help miners and their families. We'll start with the story of Robert Bailey, a former miner who worked in the mines in McDowell County, West Virginia. We first heard from Robert at a black lung conference at Pipestem in June of 2014. He was carrying a bag with an oxygen tank on his back. Medical tubes carrying oxygen from the tank ran around his ears and over his slender cheeks to his nose to keep him alive.
You might breathe as hard as you can breathe, but you can't feel the air. You're not getting any quality, no use out of it, even though you are breathing. It just don't help you. And you feel your whole system shutting down. And like you're about to melt to the floor.
Bailey's doctor told him he needed a lung transplant, which meant he didn't have much longer to live. The cost of a double lung transplant is about $800,000, according to a report from 2011. Who picks up the bill depends on which mining companies are held responsible, but the first step is to qualify for benefits. That hinges on medical evaluations and years of mining work, and that's determined by the United States Department of Labor. The agency's decisions can then be challenged by coal companies or their insurance companies. The whole process can take years.
I felt like if they delayed much time, as far as just sending my records here or there, or not being in a hurry to get approvals or whatever, that this 2 to 3 years that I might have would be pushed over and I wouldn't make it to receive a transplant like some of the other coal miners who has lost their lives waiting on that phone call or waiting on that approval.
The federal government also has a fund that covers black lung medical benefits if the coal companies are underinsured, bankrupt, or defunct. Mr. Bailey worked for now bankrupt Patriot Coal, so while the insurance approved the consultations, Bailey says the federal government ended up picking up the tab.
¶¶
It's been 15 months since Robert Bailey underwent double lung transplant surgery. I stopped by his house in Princeton, West Virginia, to find out what life is like with his new lungs.
Last time I saw you, I'm pretty sure you had tubes coming out of your nose. I could hear that it was difficult for you to breathe. Explain to us now, if you could put it into words, what it's like to be able to breathe again.
You really don't know what it feels like until you're struggling, but it's about like somebody capping their hands over your mouth, and you're trying to breathe and you're struggling and you're really working real hard, and you can feel it affecting your whole body, not just your lungs. But now, since I've had my transplant, and it's no struggle at all, and it just makes you relax and smell the roses.
Life after a transplant isn't a walk in the park. Robert has to closely monitor his health.
In this carrying case, it contains...
Robert uses a spirometer to measure his lung capacity and oxygen levels. Doctors told him to document the results twice a day.
If there's a 10% or more difference, I'm supposed to contact the hospital because I might be going into a lung rejection.
He also documents his weight and temperature twice a day. There's a whole list of physical changes to watch for that could indicate the body is rejecting the lungs.
You said lung rejection. What did the doctors tell you after you got your lung transplant about the chances of rejection?
They told me that everyone will go into rejection at one time or another, and usually it's in the first few months of your transplant. But the best of my knowledge, it's been 15 months and I haven't went into rejection the first time. So to me, that's a miracle within itself. And if you do go into rejection, they have two different kind of rejections. They got the first kind is that they can treat you, change your medication a little bit, and it will put everything back in the normal basics. But if the medicine does not treat it, they call it chronic rejection. Then once you go into chronic rejection, you have to have another transplant, or your lungs won't last very long and you won't live very long.
About 1 in 3 adults experience some kind of lung rejection within a year of the transplant surgery. About half of all adults who receive a double lung transplant, like Mr. Bailey, live 5 years after the surgery. Robert goes to pulmonary rehab for regular exercise. There, he's made friends who have actually died after their body rejected their transplanted lungs.
I kind of feel like, when's it going to happen to me? Am I prepared for it? But while I was in the hospital, I felt like I was led to be baptized once I got out and unite these new lungs with my body and God's spirit in a unity that He would oversee and take care of me and make me more as one person, like these would be my own personal lungs. And I believe that has helped me to have the better health that I have now than what I have seen some of my other friends have.
Robert realizes his days might be limited, and despite the additional duties, he tries to make good use of each and every day.
Because I usually think the day before, what am I going to do tomorrow? Because life is so short, and there's so many things that we can do or hope to do, that I try to plan it out where my time won't be wasted and that things will be accomplished for the good. I've started back at the church as helping in Operation Compassion. That's where they give out food to the needy. I've been able to go back and participate in that, where I had stopped doing that because I just wasn't really able to get in the car and then get out of it once I got there to do anything, and so I didn't go.
But perhaps the most precious time he's grateful for is his time with his family and watching his children and 9 grandchildren grow.
I've also seen my youngest one starting in school, and plus having their birthdays and realizing that how fast time does go by, that each one of them is getting older and their looks are changing and they're just growing up. And next thing you know, they're going to be grown like I am. And if I hadn't had this time added to my life, I would miss all of that.
For Robert,
He tells me that he wanted to share his story with hopes of making a difference, perhaps inspiring another miner who's battling black lung and trying to navigate the complicated benefits around health care. And he wanted to help put a face to organ donation in his community.
I've had a few people, or at least a couple, that's told me that because of what I went through, that they are now an organ donor, which makes me feel good that it gives somebody else an opportunity to have more life.
We've posted a short video of Mr. Bailey's story on our website at wvpublic.org.
The Bible's true, and yes, I'd read it, babe. The Bible's true, and yes, I'd read it. You want to go to heaven, you better believe it, too.
Still to come, we'll hear from a miner in Kentucky who is also hoping to get a lung transplant. Just how massive is this problem in Appalachia? Well, the answer is complicated, as a recent NPR investigation discovered. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
It's round the mountain I must go, babe. Round the mountain I must go. Anything happens, gonna let you know.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
On today's show, we're talking about one aspect of Cole's legacy, black lung. We just heard a story of a former coal miner who got a second chance at life after a double lung transplant. But not all miners with black lung are able to get a transplant. And as we just heard, even those who do qualify, the majority don't even live 5 years after surgery. Robert Bailey is 63 years old. But as coal seams in this region are getting thinner, even younger miners are becoming disabled. Anita Wolf works at the National Institute of Occupational Health and Safety in the Coal Workers Health Surveillance Program. We spoke with her more than a decade ago when the resurgence of black lung was first noticed.
For some reason, around 1999, we just hit a brick wall. And we started noticing in the x-rays that were coming into our program, massive disease. We were seeing disease in younger miners, some in their late 30s, early 40s. We were seeing miners progress from beginning stages of disease to the advanced stage of disease, which is called progressive massive fibrosis, at a very accelerated rate, much quicker than we'd ever seen before.
Wolf believes many factors are contributing to the problem, but mining thinner seams of coal in harder-to-reach areas is the biggest problem. In 1995, the U.S. Bureau of Mines found that the depleted coal reserves in Boone County will be able to sustain mining activities for no more than 20 years. More than 20 years later, we continue to mine coal in these last remaining reserves. Last year, Dr. David Blackley, a public health researcher, spoke with WBUR's Here and Now about the issue. Blackley works with coal miners in West Virginia, and he published a paper back in 2014 that looked at the increase of cases of black lung disease, a strain more prevalent than in the past.
And there may be several factors that can explain this. For example, in Appalachia, many coal operators are now cutting through lots of rock to mine remaining coal because many of the big, thick coal seams that were around years and years ago are now gone. They were mined. Yeah. And rock can contain high levels of silica, and we all know that silica is incredibly toxic when inhaled.
Yeah.
And mixtures of coal dust and silica dust are probably playing an important role in some of the trends that we've seen recently.
Just how many miners are diagnosed or treated for severe black lung? Well, clinic directors across Appalachia are seeing more and more advanced cases of the deadly disease. Nationwide, less than 100 cases were reported to the government in the past 5 years. Federal researchers confirmed a recent spike at just one clinic in Kentucky. But clinics around Appalachia contacted by NPR say there have been at least 1,000 cases in that time. Late last year, NPR's investigative reporter Howard Berkus looked into it in a two-part report. I spoke with Berkus about what this report means for the state of miners' health in our region.
NIOSH concludes in its report that the occurrence of progressive massive fibrosis is not really completely understood nationwide. And it suggests that it, as the agency that's supposed to be tracking the disease, has grossly undercounted it, and certainly our findings.
You also spent some time in some of these clinics. What were the medical officials, you know, who were familiar with black lung, who work around it daily, what were they telling you as you investigated this?
They're seeing miners who are now retired or who have been laid off and who generally never went to the NIOSH surveillance vans or any of the free NIOSH surveillance testing that's been offered across coal country for years. They never participated in that because they feared that if they had a positive black lung x-ray and somehow the company they worked for found out, they would lose their jobs. This is a widely held belief across Appalachia. It's actually against the law to sanction a coal miner for having a positive x-ray for getting tested. But this is widely, widely believed. And as you know, there have been so many layoffs in coal mining that miners desperately hold on to the jobs they have. And they're also, as you know, the best paid jobs in many of these communities. So the incentive for miners is to not do anything that might threaten their job. And so, you know, they avoided testing. And people are coming in now because they're out of work. It's not likely that many of these mines will ever reopen. They have they may have symptoms, or they don't have a paycheck anymore. They want to see if they have black lung, and then they want to apply for black lung benefits if they do. When you listen to these stories and you listen to these miners, you know, listen to what they say and how they say it. We have one miner from that clinic in Kentucky, Mackie Branham, who can't utter a single word without deep breaths around each word. He just turned 39 and he has 5 kids. He's only 19 years underground. Relatively young guy who has this fatal disease. And if he's lucky, he'll get a lung transplant. And if he's lucky, that transplant will give him maybe 5 to 10 more years of life. It's easy for people who aren't in Appalachia to listen to these stories and say, well, why do those people work in those mines? And why aren't they doing more to protect themselves? It's much more complicated than that. Listen to what these people are saying. Get some sense of the kind of circumstances that exist for these people in this part of the country. I think understanding is what's required here, and then maybe having a better appreciation for what's taken place.
Let's have a listen now to NPR's two-part investigative report about the hundreds of people seeking treatment for the most severe form of black lung and why it's so difficult to track the disease.
One of those case files carries the name Mackie Branham, and he was one tough coal miner. In 19 years underground, the 39-year-old from Elkhorn Creek, Kentucky, ran monstrous mining machines. Sometimes he worked double shifts and 7 straight days. His gallbladder was removed one day. He says he was back at work the next. But listen to Branham now, struggling to breathe, struggling to talk about a family legacy of black lung.
I'll probably be the first one to be this bad in the family.
And what do you mean this bad?
For it to actually be this progressive and in this bad of shape. I mean, don't get me wrong, they can't breathe, but they can still get up and walk around and do stuff. The more I talk, the more I get out of breath. It's just a lot of pressure in my chest all the times.
Branham sits in a clinic in Coal Run Village, Kentucky. A computer screen shows an x-ray of his damaged lungs with large knots of fibrotic tissue. The image lights up his tired face, reddened eyes, and the reflective stripes on his blue miner's pants. He still wears them, he says, even though he stopped working in March.
I probably will till the day I die. I've always been a coal miner, and if they would give me lungs to where I could go back tomorrow, I would. It's just in my blood.
He has progressive massive fibrosis or complicated black lung. It's the worst stage of the disease. It's incurable and it's fatal. Miners get it from inhaling coal mine dust, and it hit Branham at a much younger age and is getting worse more quickly than what used to be typical. There's nothing typical, says Brandon Crum, the clinic's radiologist, about the disease he's detecting now.
I think the percentage of black lung that we're seeing now here in central Appalachia is unprecedented in any recorded data that I can find anywhere. In this clinic, we're roughly around 9 to 10% complicated rate, which is around three times higher than even the highest reported numbers.
Federal researchers test thousands of miners for the disease, and they've reported 99 cases of complicated black lung across the entire country in the last 5 years. And yet Crum's little clinic alone, in just the last 2 years, diagnosed 70 cases. NPR checked other clinics across Appalachia. 11 responded, from Virginia to Pennsylvania. Combined, they told us, they've diagnosed 962 cases so far this decade. That's 10 times the official count.
Something's going on. Something has happened that has caused these numbers.
Ron Carson manages three clinics in Virginia, which report 644 cases of complicated black lung in just the last 3 years. He used to see it in miners in their 60s and 70s with decades underground. Now they're as young as 30 with less than 10 years of mining.
I'm not an epidemiologist or a scientist or a doctor. I just see the results that comes through the doors, and something is going on. Something major is going on.
Brandon Crum in Kentucky was so alarmed, he convinced the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health to investigate. Epidemiologist Scott Laney is publishing findings tomorrow.
The current numbers are unprecedented by any historical standard. We have not seen cases of this magnitude ever before in history in central Appalachia. The numbers of cases that we were seeing, and then with these additional cases, far exceeds anything that we were aware of.
So what happened? First of all, the federal researchers tracking the disease have missed hundreds of cases. By law, their tracking program only x-rays working miners, and the testing is voluntary. Virginia miner Charles Stanley spent 30 years mining coal, but didn't get his first chest x-ray until he was out of work.
If you're working and you go and have that stuff done and the company finds out about it, they'll find a way to get rid of you. As long as you're working and producing, you're an asset. But now, when you get something wrong with you, you become a liability, and they'll find a way to get rid of you.
That's actually against the law, says Bruce Watsman of the National Mining Association.
Those results are not shared with any employer. It's at the miner's discretion, the way the program operates today, when and if to divulge that information.
Still, the risk is widely believed and feared. More than 80% of Kentucky's coal miners stay away from the government's testing program, according to the program's reports. So most working miners are missing from the federal count, along with those retired or laid off. More than 40,000 lost their jobs since 2010. 600 mines closed with little hope of reopening. Miners then go to clinics hoping they'll qualify for black lung payments and health care. Last year alone, 3,000 showed up at Ron Carson's Virginia clinics.
I'm seeing miners now feeling that there is no hope. And now that they are unemployed or the coal mine laid off or shut down, well, I need to go and see about my black lung benefits. So they come in the door and we do the chest x-rays, and there it is.
So there are more cases now of progressive massive fibrosis, of complicated black lung, because more miners are getting tested.
But any way that you cut it, this is more disease because we haven't seen numbers of this magnitude.
Pulmonologist Robert Cohen of the University of Illinois at Chicago has tracked black lung for 30 years.
And I can't say that I've heard really anything worse than this in my career.
Cohen is so alarmed by NPR's count that he's planning a thorough study of black lung clinics nationwide to get an accurate number of sick miners like Mackie Branham, who's left gasping for air and grasping for words.
Me, I've never been scared to death. It don't bother me a bit. It's just not seeing my kids grow up. But if I had it to do over, I would do it again, if that's what it took to provide for my family as long as I have.
Branham hopes for a lung transplant, which may give him 5 to 10 more years of life. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
So as we just heard, the deadliest form of the coal miner's disease, black lung, is far more widespread than previously thought. Quite a shift from 20 years ago when it was thought the disease was close to becoming eradicated due to increased mine safety laws. In West Virginia alone, 186 cases of progressive massive fibrosis, or severe black lung, were diagnosed at federally funded lung clinics since 2009. The total is likely higher because some clinics reported only one or a few years' worth of data. In the past 3 years, clinics are reporting significant increases in severe black lung cases, from 2 to 12 times. In this same time frame, NIOSH reported just 99 cases nationwide. So what caused this increase? Again, here's Howard Berkus with the second part of this report.
Okay, we'll do one more.
Ready? In a black lung clinic in St. Charles, Virginia, former coal miner Dennis Maggard places a tube in his mouth and tries to exhale hard.
Deep breath in. Blow it hard. Keep on blowing out. Keep blowing out. Keep blowing out. Keep blowing out. And breathe back in.
Respiratory therapist Denise Glass gives Maggard bad news.
That one got you. You ended up blowing out 16% out of 100.
Check out the bed.
Well, it'd be the same if you got a 16 on your report card. Pretty bad.
When you say bad, what do you mean?
70 to 100 is considered normal. 60 and below is disabling.
Black lung is stealing Maggard's ability to breathe. He's among hundreds of miners showing up at clinics across Appalachia with severe cases of black lung, far more than federal researchers have reported. Coal mine closures and layoffs have more miners seeking testing and black lung benefits, and the stories they tell explain their disease. Maggard had more tests to undergo, so we sat down with Charles Stanley, who inhaled so much mine dust underground, he labeled his mining machine the Dust Dragon.
Well, you kept getting less coal and more rock, so you're cutting 19 inches of coal, you're cutting 50, 60 inches of rock. And you had to keep cutting more rock, cutting more rock, cutting more rock, and cutting more rock. The more rock you cut, the more dust you're going to eat.
There's so much rock cut with coal because the big coal seams are just about gone in Appalachia. The thin seams that remain are embedded in rock, and that rock is mostly quartz containing silica. Mine dust with silica is far more lethal than coal dust alone. There's also the practice of slope mining, where crews cut solid rock to reach coal seams. Mackie Branham did that in Kentucky for 6 straight months.
I worked 14, 16-hour shifts until they put another shift on.
Was this coal dust or rock dust?
Pure rock dust.
And were you breathing that dust during that time?
Well, I had my respirators on, and you'd actually have to remove it to help take a breath every once in a while because of dust. We packed so much around your filters and stuff, you couldn't get no air in. So yeah, quite a bit.
Mine dust is supposed to be controlled. Robust ventilation to sweep it away, water sprays to tamp it down, and protective masks. But those things don't always work, says Kentucky miner Barney Stanton.
Companies that I work for, most of them were really good, I mean, far as giving you things that you needed to try to protect yourself, but they don't work like they should. It's hard to wear a mask and do a physical job. Just trying to do your job, you breathe so hard, the dust will come in around the mask.
And it was risky, says Mackie Branham, to stop mining machines to make adjustments for excessive dust.
The mining is a numbers game. If you don't produce coal, they'll put somebody else in your spot that can. If I've got another man on the other side of the mines, he's cutting more coal than me, it's not going to look good on me. So, I mean, I just thought about my family, to be honest with you.
There are new and tougher federal limits on mine dust exposure. They just fully took effect in August. They get even tougher when there's excessive silica, and they were vigorously opposed by the National Mining Association. But the group's Bruce Watzman says miners are exposed to less silica now.
I think we're talking about historic exposures and not the exposures that we're seeing today. I think the miners that are working today are better protected because the silica levels have come down.
They're down 50% since 2009, according to the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration, which is directed by Joe Maine.
I think if the rules are followed as they are prescribed, we would not have these diseases. I really believe that. Now, the question is the strength of the rules that are in place adequate enough to protect miners? I think that's the question of the day.
Well, there are some holes in the new rules when it comes to silica. It can take a week or more to detect silica in dust samples, so excessive exposure isn't quickly addressed. And federal data continue to show excessive silica in some mines. It'll also be a decade or more before the effectiveness of the new rules is known, because it takes that long to detect the disease in lungs. In the meantime, there are the 1,000 cases NPR has identified. More are likely uncounted.
We've made some progress towards reducing the dust, but we have these people that it's too late for the new regulations to help them.
Evan Smith is an attorney in Whitesburg, Kentucky, who helps miners file for black lung benefits.
You're just putting more people into the system that need compensation. And so the more people we have moving into the system, the more potential burden it places on the taxpayers due to the increase in miners getting severe black lung.
And with younger miners diagnosed, black lung benefits payments and health care may be required longer. There may be more demand for expensive lung transplants, which concerns Democratic Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia.
The treatments run from $500,000 to $1 million. So if there are cases out there that have not been counted, then we have a lot of expenses that we don't expect to be there will be coming. And so we have to get the numbers straight and to make sure that they're being properly reported.
Scott worries about the Federal Black Lung Trust Fund, which is close to $6 billion in debt. It's taken on 1,000 claims that were supposed to be covered by mining companies, but they went bankrupt. The coal tax that supports the fund is set for a 50% cut in 2 years. And if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, miners will lose a specific black lung benefits provision that makes it much easier to qualify. Life without benefits and a paycheck has been tough for Mackie Branham, who is severely sick, seeking a lung transplant, and struggling to support 5 kids.
I'm in bad shape, man. I mean, I can no longer provide for my family, and I can't get out and do nothing around the house like I normally would with them. It tires your nerves up.
Just this week, Branham got good news. He was approved for state benefits and is hoping for a quick first check so he'll be able to buy presents for his kids for Christmas. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
It's been more than 3 months since this investigation aired on NPR's All Things Considered. So how is Mackie Branham?
He's hoping to get a lung transplant. He will be tested for that to see whether he can qualify this month or next month, I believe it is. And he's hoping that a lung transplant will at least enable him to breathe normally again for some period of time and may help restore some of his health. He knows that lung transplants are not a panacea. He's a relatively young guy, and he'll get maybe, you know, 5 to 10 years of life, additional life with a lung transplant. And he's hoping that he'll be able to, you know, see his kids graduate from high school and go on to college and maybe see grandchildren someday.
The NPR investigation and the NIOSH report prompted a bipartisan group of legislators to send a letter to President Trump this week asking for more money for black lung health clinics. Also, last December, Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania and Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia reached out to the federal agencies that deal with black lung, asking agencies to work together to get an accurate count of how many cases there are of progressive massive fibrosis, the worst type of black lung disease.
Since those agencies received that request from Congress, they have agreed to work together to do a couple of things. One is to come up with a more accurate count of the worst stages of black lung disease, and two, to see what the impact of increased cases of progressive massive fibrosis might be on the federal black lung program, which provides medical care and wage replacement benefits to minors with black lung. The problem, one of the problems, is that these clinics haven't been required to keep records that show the most severe cases versus all the other cases that they have. So they don't have ready access to that kind of data. Many of them are still using paper files. So it's not a simple process where they can just boot up the computer and look at a spreadsheet. Epidemiologists will have to go into each clinic and actually go through paper records in most cases. And even where clinics have digital records, they haven't made specific designations of these diagnoses of the worst stages of disease. So the researchers will have to go in and find that in the records. And they will also want to confirm those diagnoses. So they may actually have independent and blind reading of x-rays by qualified people to confirm the diagnoses, or at least a sampling of the diagnoses to make sure that they have an accurate count. And they want to eliminate any possible duplication among clinics. It's possible that someone went to more than one clinic, for example. So it's going to be a process that will take months, if not a year or longer.
Anything else you want to share, Howard?
I just think that this story, this situation, is a great example of how there is information that lies in government records. For some reason, agencies, overlook, they fail to see, and that it takes sometimes a reporter, looking at them in a different way. It takes the people directly involved in the situation, in this case, the black lung clinics, the physicians, the radiologists, the clinic directors, sort of saying there's something going on here. There's just something that isn't right. To get the agencies to look at these things in a different way.
Up next, we'll hear how a repeal of Obamacare could impact coal miners suffering with black lung. And we'll hear from former coal miner Gary Bentley, author of In the Black, a series of stories about the 12 years he worked as an underground coal miner. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
As the coal is black, and I left them in a hurry with no intentions of going back. For 10 long years I watched my is a 1 mile ride down the black hole where the sun don't ever shine.
In 2010, when President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law, it included special provisions that make it easier for coal miners to get black lung benefits. Republicans introduced an alternative plan to replace Obamacare, but the first attempt failed to get support. Still, this might not be the end of America's healthcare story. In a recent visit to West Virginia, Vice President Mike Pence vowed to keep fighting.
Even though Congress isn't ready to do it yet, President Trump will not rest, will not relent until we repeal and replace Obamacare.
If the ACA goes away, gaining black lung benefits could become more difficult, effectively harming a group of people Trump promised to protect. Kara Lofton of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports.
At the Pulmonary Rehabilitation Clinic in Scarborough, oxygen tubes dangle from the noses of three miners slowly pedaling on stationary bikes. All of these men have black lung, a disease caused by breathing in coal dust. Over time, the dust coats the lungs and causes them to harden. Hard lungs are difficult to expand and retract, which in turn makes it harder to breathe.
You try to get air in them and they don't want to cooperate with you like you did before.
That's James Bounds, one of the retired miners at the clinic. Not every coal miner gets black lung, in the same way that not every smoker gets cancer. But for those who do, the disease is devastating.
As your disease grows more in you, there's no cure for it at all. It keeps getting harder and harder until, I guess, one day when you take a last breath, that it won't expand for you no more.
Bounds currently is one of thousands of miners and widows receiving black lung benefits, compensation for the physical damage he sustained while doing his job. It took him 4.5 years to get approved, despite the fact that his lungs are so bad he has to stop moving to talk. Debbie Wills is Black Lung Program Coordinator for Valley Health Primary Care System. She says that prior to the Affordable Care Act, it was almost impossible to qualify for the compensation benefits, which are drawn from a federal trust fund that coal companies pay into. The coal companies are also supposed to pay for the black lung benefits for employees found totally disabled by their work in the mines.
Coal company lawyers would doctor shop around the country and find 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 doctors to say, yes, this miner is disabled, but it's not because of black lung.
Now it's a little bit easier, and the process may go more quickly. That's because the Affordable Care Act includes something called the Byrd Amendments. The amendments did two things. First, they shifted the burden of proof. Wills explains that instead of miners having to prove that mining caused their black lung, the coal companies have to prove that mining didn't.
Once we had the Byrd Amendments, you still have to prove that 100% disability, which is hard to prove. But if you can prove that and you've worked 15 years or longer in the mines, then you're entitled to a presumption that your disease arose from your coal mine employment.
The other part provides lifetime benefits to dependent widows who survived the death of a miner, if the miner had been receiving the benefits before his death. If the ACA is repealed without a replacement, the burden of proof may shift again, making it difficult for applicants to qualify. Earlier this month, both the House and the Senate introduced resolutions to preserve the Byrd Amendments from a broader ACA repeal. Republican West Virginia Representative Evan Jenkins, an ACA opponent, introduced the measure in the House.
I am a firm believer that Obamacare is already in a death spiral and desperately needs fixed. So while we are going to work to improve our healthcare system, I feel strongly about my resolution to make sure that the presumption relating to black lung is contained in whatever is the end product of this year.
But that end product is still a pretty big question at this point, because neither the House nor the Senate has released a full replacement plan for the Affordable Care Act. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from the Benedim Foundation, Charleston Area Medical Center, and WVU Medicine.
Thank you.
On today's show, we've talked about an unfortunate and deadly legacy of coal, black lung. We end this show with an essay from Gary Bentley. He spent 12 years as an underground coal miner in Kentucky before he left the industry in 2013. Gary writes a blog called In the Black for the rural news website The Daily Yonder. In his column, he shares stories from his career in the mines. Here, Gary's talking about rock dusting in a blog post from last August called Meet Thor. While his stories are usually found in print, Gary picked up a microphone for us so we could share this story with you.
Check, 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 check one, check two. I remember sitting on my parents' front porch telling my dad about how clean the Enterprise mine was and how strict the operator, JR, was about keeping it clean. I talked about JR's bucket inspections and that everyone knew not to come outside with an empty dinner bucket because JR said there was no man working in the mine who didn't take something to drink or something to eat with him. JR said if he didn't bring any trash out, that meant he left it somewhere in the mine, and JR demanded those mines to be treated like a home. My dad ended the conversation by telling me about the time JR fired a fellow coal truck driver because he threw a Reese's Cup wrapper out of his window as he was leaving the prep plant. The clouds of white dust made it impossible to see, but thankfully I had Thor to guide me. You gotta use the corner of the bucket to feel the rib. You can't be looking at where you're going. You gotta chalk line that rib by feel. Thor was just a year older than me and had started underground straight out of homeschool. He was tall, thin, and would have easily passed the entrance to a junior prom. I'm going to roll this curtain up while you try one more time to get that rib clean. Then I'll show you how to clean the offside rib. It's a bit trickier, but once you get the feel, it's just as easy as taking candy from a baby. As the dust cleared, I saw a line of tobacco spit come from Thor's mouth and just miss my shoulder when I traveled past him on the scoop, trying once more to clean the edge of the mine wall and floor. I'd been a scoop operator before, apparently not a very good one. I'd never worked in a mine that was kept this clean and required such attention to detail. The entryways were scraped until the rock on the bottom showed and a white line marked the intersection of the floor and the wall of every entry. This is what a scoop operator would call chalking the rib. I was told this was J.R. King's way of operating a mine, clean, organized, and safe. I slithered out of the deck of the scoop onto my knees, pulling a 40-pound bag of rock dust from the back of the scoop. Throwing the bag over my shoulder, I duck-walked around the scoop to begin dusting, as Thor fired up the scoop to clean the other side. "Hey, Gary, you be sure to get the roof real good. Don't worry about the face. I'm going to push all this gob up in there anyway. Just get the top real good. Aaron will flip out if it ain't white." I duck-walked in the 42-inch coal seam and tossed handfuls of crushed stone powder against the roof. I could feel that 80% of the work I was doing was falling back down into my shirt collar. I thought Thor was messing with me like the guys at Consol, so I stopped, allowed the dust to clear the air, and turned my head side to side, motioning for him to stop with my cap light. "Hey, Thor, this ain't sticking to the top. You just messing with me? It's all down my shirt, my nose is clogged up, and I'm going to cough up both lungs before too long." Thor just smiled and spit more jawbacker across the ground. "Come here, Bentley, let me show you how to do this." Thor grabbed a bag, tore open the top, and began slinging rock dust side to side against the roof of the mine. He was moving as fast as a man could when he's bent over and humped up like a cat taking a crap. He had covered the majority of the entry and emptied 5 bags of rock dust in less time than I'd emptied one. As the dust began to settle, he pulled out his pouch of Levi Garrett chewing tobacco, reaching out to me, gesturing for me to get a chaw. I politely declined and leaned back into the pile of coal, mud, and rock that was piled up against the mine face. "Thor, what caused you to go into the mines?" "Ah, when I got done with homeschool, I met a girl working at McDonald's. One thing led to another, and I needed a good paying job so I could marry her." "What about you, Bentley?" I was going to go to college, get a teaching degree, and this was my only chance to pay my way through. Then why are you still here? It ain't like I could have graduated by now anyway, Thor. But I found out I was making more money at Consol than I would have been teaching school, so I decided to stop wasting my money on books and tuition, buy me a nice vehicle, and start traveling with my band. As we sat 7 miles beyond the Driftmouth, leaning on the gob pile at the face of the entry, Thor and I talked about growing up and what we did back then. He was from a small community just outside of Hazard in Perry County, Kentucky. He was homeschooled his entire life and was raised in a very strict Christian home. The church was his school, his friends, and his family. Thor married at the age of 18 to a woman who already had 2 children and was struggling to provide for herself and her kids. This meant Thor had to grow up quick and find a way to make ends meet. Thor was the most mature man I had met in the mines, and he was under the age of 30. He was experienced and never had a bad word to say about the men he worked with. His only vice was his love for the church. If I were to go back to this conversation, I would tell Thor how his time in the mines would change his life. Not for the better, and maybe not for the worse, but it would definitely take a turn in a direction that neither of us had expected that day. He was a hell of a coal miner, and I'd sure like to sit down and have a chaw with him today.
That was Gary Bentley reading one of his blog entries called Meet Thor from his blog called In the Black on the Daily Yonder. On this show, we talked about black lung, an illness that's all too familiar for those of us in the coal fields. We've talked a lot on this show about the declining coal industry, and it's true, jobs are disappearing. But there are still miners getting up every morning, packing their buckets, and going to work to mine coal. Do you have any stories about working in the mines and around dust? What was it like to wear a respirator? Did you or anyone in your family suffer from black lung? Was it easy to navigate the system to get benefits? We'd like to hear from you. Send us a tweet at In Appalachia, or you might even consider recording yourself. And you can email us that at feedback@wvpublic.org. We've been listening to an episode of Inside Appalachia that originally aired back in March of this year. The NPR investigation that we spoke about is still ongoing, with more cases being uncovered. You can find more information on our website at wvpublic.org. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from NPR and WBUR's Here and Now. Music in today's show was provided by Kathy Matea as heard on Mountain Stage, Ben Townsend, Heroes Are Gang Leaders, Anna and Elizabeth, Stacy Grubb, Zach Bird with the Western Avenue String Band, and Lobo Loco. And we wanted to give a special shout out to Jason Grubb, Stacy's husband, who usually listens from Morgantown, West Virginia. Jason, we hope you enjoy hearing Stacy's song on our show, and thanks for listening. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Well,